Besides Katie, I have fallen in love with lots of stuff. I've fallen in love with baseball bats and old shirts and fat steaks and movie theaters and street signs and tire swings. But that summer, I fell in love with a green dress. We both did.
This week on Selected Shorts, falling in love with a dress and a problem with ponies.
Each one of them marks the beginning of a relationship. I don't mean to hint. It's not a hint. It's a flat-out demand. I want a pony.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great contemporary short fiction, read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City.
That's the memorable voice of Isaiah Sheffer, who for 30 years presided over Selected Shorts. Isaiah died on November 8, 2012, and we remember him with love, laughs, and thanks as the series continues. I'm Hannah Tinty, the literary commentator here at Selected Shorts and co-founder and editor-in-chief of One Story Magazine. Today's program focuses on the importance of objects in our lives. All too often, we get tangled up in things until a plastic toy, a dress, or even a simple piece of paper can start to hold not only our memories, but our deepest emotions. So we decided to dedicate an evening of performance to all the stuff in our lives. Joining us from station KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California, is one of the performers from that night, Robert Sean Leonard. Robert Sean Leonard is a Tony Award-winning actor who is well known for his role as Dr. James Wilson on the TV series House. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today on Selected Shorts.
It's my pleasure.
Our first story, Counting the Ways, which you read at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, is by Susan Perabo, author of the collection Who I Was Supposed to Be, which includes this story. And the object in Counting the Ways is a real collector's item, a dress worn by Princess Diana. Diana's glamorous life and tragic death in 1997 have been the subject of many creative works, but this story has a different take. The couple that buy Diana's high-priced memento are blue-collar. They can barely make their rent. Now, Robert, when you were reading this, did you have any strange reactions from the audience? Anything that was a surprise that made you change how you were reading it?
No, I remember very well. What I like to do, and what I assume most actors like to do, is explore emotion and find the break, find the place in the story that kind of gets you. I found it very moving. His search for her, from the very beginning, he makes it clear that he's always been searching for her, that there's a place this woman goes, there's a silent place that she withdraws into that he's never been able to follow her into. Mm-hmm. And that at first that was appealing to him, and now he wishes he could go with her. And his loneliness touched me, and his inability to reach her.
And Diana represents this kind of fairy tale, I think, for a lot of people, this idea of the princess. And then her death also meant so much and was sort of a shattering of that dream, and it seems to do the same thing to the couple in the story.
The most powerful moment for me in this story as an actor is when he's watching television and the commentator says, gosh, this dress will be worth 10 times what it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. I let that sit for a moment and let the audience go into his head and at that moment. And it's you hear the reaction. People just, it's this kind of slow build of, oh, of course, this changes everything.
Well, I'm really excited to hear how you captured these moments in this story. Before we hear Robert's reading, we wanted to advise you that this story may not be suitable for younger listeners. The story includes mature language, including references to a nude mannequin and male anatomy. Let's listen in now to Counting the Ways by Susan Perabo, performed by Robert Sean Leonard.
Katie's mother was a real piece of work. She lived like a hermit in a crappy little apartment in Newark, listening to talk radio, working crossword puzzles, and from what I could tell, just waiting to keel over dead. This broke Katie's heart, but she never stopped trying. One Sunday a month, we'd drive out to Newark, and I'd always end up balancing her mom's checkbook or unsticking her windows while Katie threw out all the stuff in the cupboards and the fridge that had gone rotten since the last time we'd been there. It wasn't even that the old lady's mind was gone. She just didn't give a shit whether her checkbook was balanced or whether her windows could open or any of her food was good. She didn't give a shit about anything, as far as I could tell. She only spoke when asked a direct question, and her answers were always polite and indifferent and short, like she was being interviewed for a job that she didn't want. She looked right through Katie like a pane of glass. Personally, I thought she was crazy, but I knew better than to say this to Katie. Finally, the old lady died. One morning, she sat down at the breakfast table and stroked out. It was me who found her 3 days later. She had nosedived into the Times crossword with her hair still wet from the shower, so when I turned her over, her whole face was stained black with crossword clues. I didn't tell Katie that part. No matter how much pain a person causes you, you don't need to hear something like that. Her mother left us $28,000. We needed it. I'd lost my job as assistant manager at the Econo Lodge North 3 months before when they closed the motel. And to make up for it, they made me part-time desk clerk at the Econo Lodge West. But between that and Katie's lousy data entry job, we were bringing in just enough to cover rent and food and the lamest insurance you could get. The inheritance was enough to let us think about moving out of the city, maybe having a kid. But Katie said no. Katie wanted to blow the money. Now, maybe if the auction hadn't been that weak, things would have turned out different. Maybe she'd have come to her senses, and maybe now we'd be living in a little house in the suburbs playing peekaboo with Joel Jr., but no. We were sitting in front of Entertainment Tonight the day after her mom's funeral, and on comes the story about the auction. I want to buy one of those dresses, Katie said, pointing at the TV with her fork. Okay, let's. Babe, I said, what are you going to do with a dress like that? Where are you going to wear it? The grocery store? She shot me the look. Don't make me say that this is my money, she said, setting her fork down on the coffee table. I don't want to have to say that. I looked at the dresses on the TV. Most of them were pretty ugly. I wouldn't have paid $100 for them, much less the 30, 40 grand they were going for. I want to do something crazy with this money, she said. Something totally unexpected. Can you understand that, Joel? I want to do something that she would never have done in a million years. It's crazy, I said. I'll give you that much. I've always loved the princess, she said sadly. This was news to me. She'd never mentioned loving the princess before. But I could see she'd made her mind up. You're probably thinking I could have talked her out of it, probably thinking I could have stood up right then and said, listen, babe, it's me or the dress. But the truth is, Katie'd had a pretty shitty life. There weren't very many things in the world that made her happy, and if she thought buying one of the princess's old dresses was going to do the trick, then I was willing to give it a try. I'd never seen the money, never laid a finger on the money. It was like Monopoly when you pass go and wind up on income tax. The money just stays in the little slots on the bank. When I got home from my shift the next night, the dress was in the bedroom. It was mossy green, had a curvy neck and a skirt as round as a barrel. She'd bought a mannequin, too, an extra 100. Stood it in the corner of the bedroom by the wastebasket. The mannequin had a shiny, bald head, and its eyes were the size of peanuts. What do you think? Katie asked. She was standing beside the mannequin with her hand resting easy on its shoulder, like they'd been best friends since kindergarten. It looks like an alien, I said. She scowled. The dress, Joel. What do you think of the dress? It's nice, I said. What could I say? It was a green dress. She danced in this, Katie said. She went to a ball and danced in it. Her skin touched it. I unbuttoned my yellow Econo Lodge shirt and bowed to the mannequin. Princess, I said, holding out my hand, may I have this dance? I lifted the mannequin and held it tight against me, pressed my nose against its hard shoulder. The dress smelled like a sandwich bag. I twirled the mannequin around and around in circles, singing oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa, until I was dizzy. Katie sat on the bed, clapping and laughing. "Look at you," she said. "My handsome prince." I set the mannequin back in the corner, yanked Katie off the bed, and danced her once around the room and then down onto the covers. "Princess," I said, not cracking a smile. "May I have this dance?" She giggled and got all red in the face. This never stopped amazing me, how your own wife could blush when you started making love to her, get all lit up like you had just moseyed out of a fairy tale, like she didn't throw your underwear in the washing machine every week or pick your hair out of the shower drain, like she didn't know what a screw-up you were. Besides Katie, I have fallen in love with lots of stuff. I've fallen in love with baseball bats and old shirts and fat steaks and movie theaters and street signs and tire swings. But that summer, I fell in love with a green dress. We both did. We treated that dress like a lover and a baby and the old blind family dog. Part of it was the money, but it was more than that. It was the way she stood there in the corner, hearing everything and seeing everything, taking it all in and never asking for anything back. We stopped smoking in the bedroom. When it was nice out, we'd open the blinds and let the afternoon sun fall on the green shoulders. One day I came home from the grocery store. I heard Katie talking in the bedroom. I set my bags down real quiet and snuck up to the door and took a peek in. She was trying on scarves. There were a whole bunch of them lying on the bed. She tied a blue one around her neck and posed in front of the mannequin. "What do you think?" she asked. "Is it me?" "It's you," I said. She whirled around, and for a second, I thought she was going to get pissed off at me, but she smiled. "Let's go out to dinner," she said. "Out?" I couldn't remember the last time we'd been out to dinner. I couldn't remember the last time we'd eaten off anything besides the coffee table. "You're off tonight, right? So let's forget the groceries and go out and have a fancy meal." "What are we celebrating?" I asked. "Why do we have to be celebrating anything?" She went to the bathroom to brush her hair, and I stood there looking at the mannequin, wishing I could think of some way to pay her back for this rare gift. We'd had her for 2 weeks, and the magic hadn't worn off yet. "Hey, Joel." I went into the bathroom, wrapped my arms around my wife, and looked at us in the mirror. "Knock, knock," she said. Now, this got me. I used to do this all the time, and it always drove her crazy. Every time I'd said knock, knock in the last 6 months, she'd rolled her eyes and said, "Nobody's home." "Who's there?" I said. "Mannequin." "Mannequin who?" "Mannequin use a night out with my husband." I kissed her shoulder and said, "Baby, that really stinks." A week later, Katie started having trouble at the office. She said that one of the bosses was getting a little friendly with his hands, massaging her neck and stuff when she was at the computer. I didn't know whether to really believe her. She wasn't exactly a liar, but sometimes she exaggerated things a little. I offered to go down to the office and kick the guy's ass anyway. "Be realistic," she said to me. "What good would that do?" We were in bed. She'd had her head in the crook of my elbow, and my arm was already asleep, my fingers tingling. We slept this way most of the time. Sometimes when I got up in the morning, my arm hung dead for 10-15 minutes. "Why don't you report him?" I said. "Yeah, Joel, I'm sure they'd fire him right away." "So quit," I said. "Get a new job." "We're barely making out as it is," she said. She sat up, and I shook her weight out of my arm. She reached into the nightstand and got out a pack of smokes. "Babe," I said, tossing my head at the mannequin. "Come on. You don't want her to stink, do you?" She fingered the unlit cigarette. "We're pathetic," she said. "I can't even afford to be out of work for a goddamn week." And this was pretty much true. My hours at the motel were getting cut back a little at a time. I was looking around for more work, but I couldn't find anything. There were about 11,000 guys in the city with desk clerk experience. "I'll get a second job," I said. "I'll flip burgers or something." The cigarette broke in her fist. "You're not going to flip burgers," she screamed at me. She screamed every once in a while, out of the blue, a big fat one like this. Then she said this thing that killed me. "Just imagine what my mother would say about you flipping burgers." I sat bolt up in bed, spoke before I had time to think. If you're so worried what your mother would say, why in hell did we blow 30 grand on a goddamn dress? She shot out of bed and stormed out of the room. I took a breath and started counting. This was something I'd learned from my dad. You don't go after them, he said. You start counting. They'll be back before you hit 10. But the truth was, I'd never been able to do it, not with Katie. Usually by the time I hit 3, I was so full of guilt and panic I'd go after her. This time I made it to 5. I hauled myself out of the bed and slunk into the living room. She was sitting on the couch, sucking on a cigarette. Babe, I said. You love the dress, she shouted. I've seen you, you know, looking at her all moony-eyed. You love it just as much as I do. You're right, I said, leaning against the doorway, looking at my bare feet. Settle down, babe. You're right. I'm sorry. But she wasn't listening. The magic of the dress had finally worn off, and she had tunneled back to that place inside of her, the place with no name and no address and no closing time. There was a time once when I thought that that place made her beautiful, and I wished I could go with her. But now I thought that place was just like her mother's. It was cold, it was quiet, and too small to hold more than one. So then it was Saturday night. I was behind the desk at work, checking some fat couple in, and the man looked up at me and said, "Have you heard?" "What's that?" I said, grabbing his room key from the box on the wall. People were always trying to tell me things, having been cooped up in their cars all day. I usually half-listened. "The princess and her boyfriend had a car accident," the wife said. "Boyfriend's dead. The princess might be, too." My shift was just about over. I didn't want to call Katie. I figured if she'd heard, she would have called me at the motel, and I didn't want to have to tell her over the phone. I sat there picking my fingernails until the overnight guy came in and then beat home. There are things you never forget. For me, there's three. When I was 11, I saw one of the kids in my class get his foot run over by the school bus. He was joking around, sticking his foot under the tire and then pulling it out. He was one of those kids who was always doing stuff like that. Anything for an audience. He must have thought the bus driver saw him. But then I heard the groan of the bus starting up and the tire rolled over this kid's foot. And the kid just stood there. What else could he do? He just stood there. His face flush against the side of the yellow bus and his Reebok flat as a dollar bill on the pavement. Then one time, about a year before I met Katie, I saw an old Chinese woman fixing her wig on the bus in the middle of the night. She was using the window as a mirror and kept tilting the wig this way and that, but no matter which way she tilted it, it still looked like a hat. Then finally she just took the wig off and held it between her knees and pet it like a cat. Anyway, the other one happened that Saturday night. I swung open the door to the apartment, saw Katie. You're sitting on the couch, all wrapped up in a brown blanket like a big caterpillar. Right next to her, standing propped up, in the middle of the couch, was the mannequin. They're both looking at the TV, exactly the same expression. Then the guy on TV goes, "The silence is disturbing." "Is she dead?" I asked. "We don't know," Katie said. She didn't even look at me. And I wondered who the "we" was. We as in the whole world? Every poor slob sitting on pins and needles in front of his TV at midnight, or we as in Katie and the mannequin? "What happened?" I asked. "They were going home," she said. I didn't say anything else. I went into the kitchen and grabbed a couple beers, went sat on the couch on the other side of the mannequin. I cracked my beer, then Katie's, but when I held it across the mannequin's skinny shins, she wouldn't take it. "We've had no word for some time now," the TV guy said. "One can only imagine this means that the injuries to the princess may be more severe than we were first led to believe." "Jesus," I said. I reached across the mannequin again, set my hand on the blanket where I supposed Katie's knee would be, but she jiggled herself and my hand fell away. The TV guy had his fingers pressed against his earpiece. Behind him, a whole bunch of people were sprinting around with sheets of paper in their fists, yelling stuff. I started to feel sick to my stomach, and I wanted to turn the TV off, take my wife for a drive, pick up vanilla shakes like we used to do, and drive around the city talking about what we were going to be when we finally grew up. "We're getting a report now," The TV guy said, I'll give him this. He didn't look excited. Like some guys do when they tell you about a plane exploding or somebody shooting up at McDonald's. He looked like he'd rather be anywhere other than in our living room. We're getting an unconfirmed report now, he said, that the princess has died. I felt my hand moving again. I was going for Katie, but I felt the folds of the green dress under my fingers, and I held tight. I wanted to throw up, so I set down my beer. Katie whispered something.
What?
I said. It's unconfirmed, she said. It's unconfirmed. But I knew what that meant. Only that it meant nobody important would say the words, but that the words were out there already. And I imagined how she was lying on a table in a room all alone, and the tubes were already unhooked, and she was already growing cold. 2 hours after it was confirmed, and Katie had baby-stepped her caterpillar self to bed, I was still sitting in the living room, my feet on the coffee table, stinking drunk and chain-smoking the last of the cigarettes we had in the house. They were showing pictures of the car being towed out of the tunnel, its front end crunched like a wad of tinfoil, the mannequin still standing beside me, and I was just plastered enough to pull it over onto my lap and let its little head rest on my thigh. I straightened out the sleeves and set the collar right. You're probably thinking I kissed it or something, but I didn't. Wouldn't have seemed right, even as drunk as I was. Them talking about how she held out alive for a time, asking questions, how it took an hour just to cut her out of the car, how her boys were likely just now being woken up by their father. I just let my hand rest on the sleeve and stared at the pictures, which were clouded from the smoke in the room and blurry from the beer in my head. It was around 4 when some old English lady being interviewed looked right out of the TV, right at me, and said, "It's terrible to say, at the time such a tragedy, but the dresses that were recently sold at auction will no doubt now be worth 10 times what they were last month." My cigarette dropped from my lips to my shirt. I slowly lifted my hand off the dress. My first thought was to act right then, like I could have stumbled out onto the street with a mannequin and there'd be some guy waiting on the sidewalk with a sack of money. I'd redeem the dress like a lottery ticket, have it over and done with by the time Katie woke up in the morning, deal with her tears by showing her the money. In my crazy head, all 300 grand of it. Enough to buy a house away from the city and live off of. Live off of, not work, for a long, long time. Then I thought of Katie's mom, dead like the princess, how it had turned out we had done something smart with the cash after all, invested in fate and hit the jackpot. I thought of the old lady with her face stained black and her life stained black, and how it had seemed all she would ever leave in her wake was that damned blackness. But here, life had twisted itself up again in that way it does when you least expect it. And now, on what was surely the blackest of nights for so many, me and Katie finally had a little bit of light. "No way," Katie said, pouring herself a tumbler of grapefruit juice. "No f***ing way." I was prepared for this. I'd woken up early with only a baby hangover and figured out how to convince her. "Listen, babe," I said. "Here's the first thing we do with the money. We fly over there, over to England, and we go to the funeral, and we put flowers and stuff at the gate." "Everybody puts flowers at the gate," she said, swallowing a handful of aspirin with her juice. "What we have is special. It was special before, and it's even more special now." "Listen to this, though," I said. "We can send flowers every week. We can get a different bouquet every week and send it over there for the rest of our lives if we want to." "We bought that dress with my mother's money," she said. "That may not mean anything to you, but it means something to me." "Babe," I said, "your mom is dead. Don't you think it's about time to move on?" Move on. Those words were foreign to Katie. It was scrawled all over her blank face. I might as well have been trying to teach the roaches in the corner to tie my shoes. The dress makes me happy, she said. Okay, I may not have known what happy was, but I was pretty sure I knew what it wasn't. It wasn't crying in the shower, and it wasn't staring at the same page of a magazine for an hour. It wasn't reading birthday cards your mother sent you when you were a kid, and it wasn't making up stories about what people did to you at work. It wasn't crossing your arms when your husband put his hand on your breast, and it sure as hell wasn't swallowing a handful of aspirin with your f***ing grapefruit juice. I should have said all this. Hell, any of it. But all I could think of to say right then was, we can have a real life, Katie. She dropped her tumbler in the sink, and it clattered around in there for a couple of seconds. Then everything was quiet. Except a couple of blocks away, some idiot's car alarm was going off, whooping it up for the whole neighborhood. We have a real life, Katie said. Okay, then. A better real life. She snorted, and I felt it coming. There was only one thing to do when it was coming, and that was batten down the hatches, close myself up so whatever shit was about to fly out of her mouth wouldn't be able to touch me. Better? She said. How are we going to be better? You'll still be the same stupid old you, and I'll still be the same stupid old me, and we'll still be the same stupid us. What's so f***ing great about that? She walked off and left me standing there in the kitchen. A second later, the bathroom door slammed shut. At this point, there was no point. She'd hit bottom, and I'd learned a long time ago that when she was at the bottom, there was no rope long enough for me to haul her out with. I could have waltzed her into heaven, and she would have looked around and snorted and said, "What's so f***ing great about this?" I made it to 7 before I found myself standing in front of the bathroom door. The wood was cheap, thin enough to knock down in one good shove. The sound of my knocking, the familiar hollow sound. Babe, I said. Hey, babe, you okay? When I got home from work that night, the apartment was spanking clean. There was a bottle of champagne sitting in the middle of the coffee table. Katie? I yelled. She came floating out of the bathroom, all light and smiles, pointing a long finger at me and broke into song. If you were a rich man, she sang. Katie was in Fiddler on the Roof in high school. I don't know, every once in a while she would dredge it up, start singing her lungs out. One time the guy next door banged on the wall with a pan until she quit. What's up? I asked. She stopped yada-da-da-dying. What's up, she said. We are $190,000 up. My legs went jello when I sat on the couch. You sold it? Not yet, she said, but I found a buyer. I called the auction house, and it turns out there's this guy who's come into town. He's buying a whole bunch of them. We're not the only ones with brains. $190,000? That was his offer, she said. I took it. I was reeling. I wanted to ask her what it was that made her change her mind. After all that crap about her mother, all that crap about happy, but no, I thought, why start? This was what I wanted, wasn't it? Even then I knew that what I wanted had nothing to do with what went on in her mind. Her mind shifting like the wind, sweeping me along whichever way she wanted to go. Open the champagne, she said. There's more in the fridge. I quit my job, and I told that moron downstairs that we'd be moving at the end of the month. Moving? She sat down next to me and grabbed my arm. Like we always talked about, we can buy a house now. We can get a big dumb dog from the pound and roast marshmallows in the fireplace every night. Can you imagine? Looking at her face, her eyes, I could. She popped the cork on the champagne and exploded all over us, knocking me out of my daze. I licked it off her neck and sucked it out of her hair, and we kissed on the couch until the bottle was gone. Then we went for bottle number 2 and headed for the bedroom. She was there in the corner. Katie had gotten the plastic bag out of the closet, and it was hanging over the curtain rod. Let's put it in the bag, Katie said. Now? I was already halfway out of my pants. Now, she said. She flopped down across the bed on her stomach and propped her chin in her palms. We don't want to look at the dress all night, she said. We'll just feel too guilty. I stepped out of my pants and approached the mannequin. Suddenly, I felt funny, standing there in my shorts about to take the dress off. I felt like I was in 7th grade. and I blushed. "Come on, Joel," Katie said. "Strip her." I wondered if she was getting some kind of weird kick out of this. You never knew with Katie what was going to get her going. I stepped carefully behind the mannequin and started working on the top button. It was tiny, tight, and I was drunk. I couldn't get the damn thing unbuttoned. I looked over her shoulder at Katie. "You do it," I said. She smiled. "Uh-uh." I was starting to get pissed off. I kept fumbling with the button and finally got it done, went to the next one. I was wondering who else had unbuttoned this dress. The prince? Some lover? Or the maid? Or whatever, like in movies? Some fat-cheeked woman who undressed the princess and then tucked her into bed with a cup of tea? Finally, I reached the last button. I came around to the front of the mannequin and gathered the skirt in my hands, and I gently lifted it above her hips. I had to swivel the arms up to get the thing off her head. And when it was off, I slipped the bag over it, went to the living room, hung it up in the kitchen. Then I went back into the bedroom. Katie's clothes were in a pile on the floor, and she was under the sheets, staring up at the ceiling. "You want some more champagne?" I said. "Nope," she said. "Just you." I clicked off the lights, stripped off the rest of my clothes, and slid under the sheets beside her. "Are you happy?" I asked her. "Yeah," she said. "Really?" "Really," she said. I had drunk enough champagne to flatten a moose. But after Katie fell asleep, I lay wide-eyed in the dark bedroom. I kept trying to think about what I would do with all the money. But every so often, a sweep of lights came across the window and lit up the mannequin, and I couldn't help but stare. She was pale now, naked, her breasts nippleless, the area between her legs smooth and sexless, like a Lone Ranger toy I had when I was a kid, who, when I took off his cowboy pants, had no penis, no balls, no nothing. Her arms were still swiveled over her head, and there was a wide scar across her waist where tomorrow we would unscrew her and toss her into a dumpster out back. She was looking at me with those eyes. We were set to meet the buyer at the Hilton. At 10:30, we rolled out of bed, grabbed the dress, went out front, and waved down a cab. I was starting to feel sick. The champagne from last night still churning in my stomach. I glanced over at Katie. She looked a little sad. I wanted to ask her what she was thinking, but she was watching the city go by, and she didn't look like she was in the mood for talking. By the time we were in the lobby of the Hilton, I could taste the bile at the back of my throat, and I told Katie to go on up to the guy's room, that I had to go to the John and toss my cookies. I didn't think the guy would mind waiting. She looked mad. "Baby," I said, "I don't want to barf all over the guy." "Okay," she said, "but hurry up." It took me about 10 minutes to get presentable after puking. I washed up and slicked down my hair and tucked in my shirt and took the elevator up to the 6th floor where the buyer was staying. I went to room 604 and gave the door a good rap. The guy opened it. He was an old guy, had a gray beard and rectangle glasses. He was wearing a red cardigan sweater that was kind of faded and... Well, he didn't look like a guy who would have $1 million to spend on dresses, or anything, for that matter. He put his hand out. "Joe?" "Yes, sir," I said, like he was the principal of the Hilton. "You're late," he said. I shrugged. I had to make a pit stop. I wished I'd thought of something else to say, but it got out before I could think of anything better. I looked over his shoulder for Katie. "Where's the dress?" he asked. Right then, I could hear all the clocks in the hotel ticking. I could hear them so clear. It was like they were right behind my eyes, ticking away my life. "My wife has it. She's not here?" He stepped back to show me the room. There was a glass pitcher of Bloody Mary on the desk and 3 gray suits hanging in the closet and half a muffin on the table, and Granny Clampett was on TV playing the ukulele. "She came up before me," I said. "She must have gotten off on the wrong floor or something." "Shall we have a drink while we wait?" Sure, I said. I followed him into the room. My palms were all sweaty, but I took the glass in his hand and drank the Bloody Mary in one big gulp. He raised his eyebrows and poured me another, then flipped off the TV. I sat down on the bed holding the glass in my hands. "How long have you had the piece?" I looked at him. I must have looked like a retard. I felt like a retard. My thoughts flopping through my head like syrup. The dress, he said. How long have you had it? About a month. He looked at his watch. Shall we call the front desk? Why? To see if your wife's there. Lost, perhaps. I shook my head slowly. She's not lost, I said. She's gone. He sat down beside me, and the weight of the bed shifted, and I nearly fell over on top of him. In a way, I wished I had. Sometimes you just want to feel somebody's hands on you. Gone? She must have changed her mind, I said. I set the Bloody Mary on the floor between my feet. I wondered when the idea had hit her. Wondered if it was when she was standing in the elevator all by herself with the dress, waiting for the doors to slide open. Or maybe it was before then. In the cab when she was staring out the window, the excitement worn off and the realization coming on that it was just another sad day like all the rest. Well, surely she's just... The guy started. No, I said, no. I should have figured. He frowned. I thought he was going to be mad at me. Tell me to get the hell out of his room. He had other fish to fry. He was a big shot. But he stood up and looked into the mirror. He stared into it. He looked past himself for a long time. Well, he said finally, she must be waiting for you somewhere. Yeah, I said, she must be. Then I started counting, without even thinking about it. On three, I looked at my feet, waiting for them to move, but they didn't. On six, I took a deep breath and waited for myself to stand up, but I didn't, and I couldn't figure it out. When I hit 10, I got up slow, but instead of heading for the door, I walked to the window, looked down 6 floors to the sidewalk in front of the hotel. She was there, all right. The dress was folded over her arm, and her hair was taking the breeze. She was just waiting. Standing still in the middle of the crowds moving past. She must have been thinking that I'd be down any second to tell her I didn't care that she'd changed her mind, to tell her that whatever she wanted was A-okay with me. And who could blame her? What had I ever done to make her think I could do anything else? I opened my mouth to ask the guy if he minded if I hung around a little longer. Maybe I had another drink with him, but when I turned my head to ask, he was already behind me, holding out my glass. I took it from him, turned back to the window, looked below me at all the people swarming the sidewalks who didn't know me and didn't know Katie and didn't know that this time she was going to wait there forever. The old guy in the sweater. He was the only one who knew, and I didn't even know his name.
Robert Sean Leonard read Susan Perabo's Counting the Ways. Robert, thank you for giving us a glimpse behind the Selected Shorts curtain.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or to hear about the Selected Shorts writing contest, go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. We'd love to hear any questions or comments you have about these stories, so please write in and let us know your thoughts. Our next piece, The Pony Problem, comes from Sloane Crosley's best-selling collection of essays, I Was Told There'd Be Cake. Sloane's most recent book is How Did You Get This Number? She talked a little bit about the background of this piece at Symphony Space.
I kept asking it for a certain toy long after I had ceased wanting it. It was just this weird habit because I became a person who was attached to this kind of object. Normally this happens with little kids where, you know, purple is your favorite color for a month and then all of a sudden people keep on getting you purple things for the rest of your life. And the danger is when you're a grown-up, it can happen with relationships and humans and people where you keep sort of doing the same thing and the same behavior. Expecting a different result, which we all know that what that means. This idea of how do you behave and how do the objects in your life come into play.
That was essayist Sloane Crosley speaking from the stage of Symphony Space. Now let's see how she does her spring cleaning in The Pony Problem, read by Kirsten Bangsness.
As most New Yorkers have done, I have given serious and generous thought to the state of my apartment should I get killed during the day. Say, someone pushes me onto the subway tracks, or I get accidentally blown up. Or a woman with a headset and a baby carriage wheels over my big toe, backing me into some scaffolding, which shakes loose a lead pipe which lands on my skull. What then? After the ambulance, the hospital, the funeral, the trays of cheese cubes on foil toothpicks. Back in the apartment, I never should have left. The bed has gone unmade and the dishes unwashed. The day I get shot in a bodega buying cigarettes, naturally, will in all likelihood be the day before Laundry Sunday and the day after I decided to clean out my closet, got bored halfway through, and opted to watch sitcoms in my prom dress instead. I have pictured my loved ones coming to my apartment to collect my things, and I have hoped that it would only be lived-in messy, bras drying on the shower curtain rod, muddy sneakers by the door. But that is never going to happen. My dust balls alone have a manifest destiny that drives them far beyond the ruffle of the same name. I like to think that these hypothetical loved ones would persist in their devotion to dead me no matter what. They would literally be blinded by grief, too upset putting sweaters in boxes to notice that I hadn't dry cleaned them in a year. That is, until one of them made his or her way into the kitchen. "Where are you going?" my father would ask. "Packing up her bedroom's much too painful," my mother would tell him, choking back the tears. "I'm going to start on the kitchen." This is the part I dread. This is the part where my mother would open the drawer beneath my sink only to discover my stash of plastic toy ponies. There are about 7 of them in there. Correction, 1's a Pegasus, blue with ice skates. The rest vary in size, texture, and realism. Some are covered in brown felt. Some have rhinestone eyes. Some come with their own grooming brushes. Others with the price sticker still on their haunches. If they arrived in plastic and cardboard packaging, they remain unopened as if they will appreciate like Star Wars figurines. Perhaps they're not the dirtiest of dirty secrets, but they're about as high as one can get on the oddity scale without a ringer like toenail clippings. I'm not exactly sure how the ponies happened, though I have an inkling. "Can I get you anything?" I'll say, getting up from a dinner table. "Coffee? Tea? A pony?" People rarely laugh at this, especially if they've heard it before. "This party's supposed to be fun," a friend will say. "Really?" I'll respond. "Will there be pony rides?" It's a nervous tic, and a cheap joke, cheapened further by the frequency with which I use it. For that same reason, it's hard to weed out of my speech. Most of the time, I don't even realize I'm saying it. There are little elements in a person's life, minor fibers that become unintentionally tangled with our personality. Sometimes it's a patent phrase, sometimes it's a perfume, sometimes it's a wristwatch. For me, it's the constant referencing of ponies. I don't even like ponies. If I made one of my throwaway equine requests and someone produced an actual pony, Juan Valdez style, I would run very fast in the other direction. During a few summers at camp, I rode a chronically dehydrated pony named Brandy, who would jolt down without notice and lick the grass outside the corral, and I would careen forward, my helmet tipping to cover my eyes. I do, however, like ponies in the abstract. Who doesn't? It's like those movies with animated insects. Sure, the baby cockroach seems cute with the CGI eyelashes, but how would you feel about 50 of her real-life counterparts living in your oven? And that's precisely the manner in which the ponies clomp their way into my regular speech. Abstractly. I have something for you, a guy will say on our first date. Is it a pony? No. It's usually a movie ticket, or his cell phone number, or a slobbery tongue kiss. But on our second date, if I ask again, I'm pretty sure I'm getting a pony. And thus the pony drawer came to be. It's uncomfortable to admit, but almost every guy I have ever dated has unwittingly made a contribution to the stable. The retro pony from the 50s was from the most thoughtful guy I have ever known. The one with the glitter horseshoes was from a boy who would later turn out to be gay. The one with the rainbow haunches was from a pot dealer. And the one with the price tag stuck on the back was given to me by a narcissist who was so impressed with his gift that he forgot to remove the sticker. Each one of them marks the beginning of a relationship. I don't mean to hint. It's not a hint. It's a flat-out demand. I want a pony. I think what happens is that young relationships are eager to build up a romantic repertoire of private jokes, especially in the city where there's not always a great how we met story behind every great love affair. People meet at bars, through mutual friends, on dating sites, or because they work in the same industry. Just once, a guy asked me out between two express stops on the N train. We were holding the same pole, and he said, "I know this sounds crazy, but would you like to go to a very public place and have a drink with me?" I looked into his seemingly non-psycho-killing, rent-paying, Sunday Times subscribing eyes and said, "Yes. Yes, I would." He never bought me a pony, but he didn't have to. If I subtract the overarching strangeness of being a grown woman with a toy collection, I like to think of the ponies as a tribute to my type. I date people for whom it would occur to them to do this. This is not such a bad thing. These are men who are creative and kind. They hold open doors and pour wine. If I joined a cult, I like to think they would come rescue me. No, the fulfilling of the request isn't the problem. It's the requesting that's off. They don't know yet that I make it all the time, and I don't have the heart to tell them how whorish I am with my asking. For them, it's a deleted scene out of Good Will Hunting. For me, it's Groundhog Day. They have no reason to believe they're being unoriginal. Probably because they're not. I am. What am I asking when I ask for a pony but to be taken for more unique than I probably am? The ponies, if by accident, have come to represent the most overly sentimental part of my life, because all of these relationships have ended, and they have ended more or less badly. No affair that begins with such an orchestrated overture can end on a simple note. What I am left with is the relics of those relationships. After a breakup, I'll conduct the normal breakup rituals. I'll cut up photographs, erase voicemails, gather his dark concert t-shirts I once slept in and douse them with bleach before I use them to clean my bathtub. But not the ponies. When I go to throw them away, I feel like a mother about to slap her child for the first time, to cross a line she never intended to cross. She's spitting mad, the arm flies up, and it never comes down. Yet I feel a pressure to do something with the ponies. Statistically speaking, my chances of getting smacked on the head with a lead pipe are increasing every time I lock the door behind me. Also, a drawer full of beady-eyed toys is insanely creepy. But what to do? Actual love letters I do in stages. I biannually clean out drawers of nonsensical items. Receipts, loose AA batteries, rubber bands of indeterminate origin, and stumble across a love letter. Unable to throw it out, I stick it in another drawer, crammed at the bottom, until I clean that one out, too, and finally throw the letter out. One romantic note generally goes through a minimum of 3 locales before it gets tossed out for good. But the ponies are uncrammable. They're 3-dimensional and bubblegum-scented and impossible to hide, even from myself. Every time I open the drawer, it's a trip down memory lane, which, if you don't turn off at the right exit, merges straight into the masochistic nostalgia highway. They are too embarrassing to leave out in the open, facing west like a collection of China elephants. They're too many to slide under the sofa. They are too plastic to wedge behind the radiator. I want to send them around the world like the Travelocity gnome. Have them come back to me years from now when I have an attic in which to shut them away. As if this all weren't enough, there was that flash of my mother dressed in black, staring aghast into the open kitchen drawer. In a city that provides so many strange options to be immortalized by the local tabloids, it's just as important to avoid humiliation in death as it is in life. "What is it?" my father would shout, imagining all the things you'd never like to think of your father imagining. Flavored condoms, pregnancy tests, a complete set of the Third Reich collector's cards. "Look!" my mother would howl, picking up ranch princess pony with matching bridle and real horseshoe charm necklace by her faux flaxen mane just before she passed out. My first thought is to go to the Salvation Army and donate the ponies to the children. But the notion turns me into an insta-hippie. The ponies have bad karma. I wouldn't just be giving some kid Stargazer with the glow-in-the-dark mane. I would be giving her manic depressive Simon, who talked back to billboards and infomercials and kicked me in his sleep. My next idea is to leave the ponies in the trash for a homeless person to find and sell on the street. But I can't risk seeing them on a table with used books and polyester scarves as I walk to the subway each morning. I think about burying them in the park, but I have my doubts about the ponies' biodegradability. I think about burning them, melting them into a puddle of plastic as their real-life counterparts were once melted for glue. Maybe I'll just sneak out to the reservoir after dark with a raft made from pool noodles and rubber bands and give them a Viking funeral. While each subsequent idea is tilled from a progressively more unsophisticated plot, I know that I can't simply throw the ponies out with the recycling. The ponies have their roots in me, not the other person. They are my nervous habit, my odd little secret. While each serves as a memory of a specific individual, each memory is filtered through the same brain, mine. The ponies are part of me. They deserve better than that. The keeping of love letters suddenly seems like a petty crime. I have the romantic equivalent of a body in the freezer. So I put the ponies in a black plastic bag, grabbing them out of their drawer like a jewel thief who, for the sake of urgency, does not consider the preciousness of each object. I tie the bag in a knot, leave the apartment, and take them with me on the subway. I get on a sparsely populated car, drop them between my legs, and begin casually pushing them further under the seat with my heels. Then, just as casually, I forget to take them with me when I get up. I leave them there on the N train, bound for Brooklyn. Of course, the second the door shut, I realize what I've done. Actually, that's not true. The second the door shut, I feel great. Sneaky and great and nostalgia-free. Second after that, I realize what I have done. In my effort to liberate myself from the ponies, I have given some poor girl at the end of the subway car a solid reason to think she might not make it back to her apartment that night. A suspiciously abandoned, unmarked package on public transport. I wonder what must be racing through her mind as she sits motionless, unable to turn her gaze away from the lumpy plastic bag. I wonder if she flashes back to her apartment, to the dust, to the expired yogurt in the fridge, to the terrible DVDs that she won't be able to explain were a gift. Perhaps she has her own holy grail of humiliation. Perhaps there's a collection of porcelain bunnies in the medicine cabinet. In any case, ponies are gone. They're on their way to a burrow where eventually they will hit the end of the line and cycle back into the heart of the city, unless the bomb squad finds them first. They're finally out of my sight, and not even an 8.5 on the nostalgia Richter scale can summon them back. I created them, and now I have uncreated them, and there is nothing I can do about it. Except maybe to continue to look both ways before crossing the street and avoid areas with a high saturation of random violence. I breathe a sigh of resolute relief. From now on, I will make a conscious effort to remember. Should I find myself face to face or pipe to skull with the end of my life? That the real proof that I have tried to love and that people have tried to love me back was never going to fit in a kitchen drawer. Thank
you. Kirsten Bangsness performed The Pony Problem by Sloane Crosley. If you've ever thought of writing a short story yourself, here's your chance. Each year, Symphony Space conducts the Stella Kupferberg Short Story Prize competition, in which listeners submit new works. For more information, go to selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Parada. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trusts Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.